Exception number 8941, rule number 10. Major Jefferson, rule 10.
Going on from the last tape, where we were just after the battles of the 2nd and 3rd, and I'd taken over Don Troop, and I was trying to get a fix on the events around that day of the pictures we've just seen, when the Italians were shot up by the Germans because they wanted to surrender. And I quoted from Tug Wilson, who was command post GPO assistant in Don Troop on the 2nd of July, and he kept a diary, and in his diary he showed very clearly that he had fixed the 2nd of July on paper as a day of importance. And he then goes on, "There is a brief note in my diary that I became your OPAC on July the 5th. In other words, I was already troop commander by July the 5th. So that picture of the guns firing must have been July the 4th. And indeed, I'd already been appointed by then, but I didn't have anything to shoot with." And he goes on, "There is an even briefer note on July the 8th, Honeys. You no doubt remember that." And perhaps at a later stage, when we get to July the 8th, Honeys will be the key word. "I note that we were in a party on the night of July the 16th. And again for July the 29th, there was something going on, but I have no idea what. Perhaps it was the night I drove the armoured car into an unmarked minefield. Do you remember? At first light, you guided me out in reverse with hand signals." Those were the signposts I was looking for, because those are in his diary at that time and are accurate.
What day was it that the Italians tried to give up then? Was that the
4th? It must have been July the 4th. That fixed it fairly clearly. Yeah.
How did that come about, and what did you see of it?
Well, I didn't see anything. I was on the gun position, because I say we had the HAC chaps out in the OPs, and those pictures you've just seen of what was left of the regiment were at the gun position.
So the OPs saw this?
The OPs saw it and reported it, and they're typically yeomanry voices. But I didn't see it. But it happened, I know. Equally, I've got a picture of some Indian infantry. I haven't got it there because it's less interesting to me, but in the War Office collection of that day, on which those pictures are taken, the Indian infantry are actually looking at shells landing in the far distance at about where the Italians are trying to give themselves up.
What sort of gun positions were your troop in for the 4th?
On the 4th, flat sand. I mean, I don't know that that was any better or worse than any other day at that time.
They weren't in pits.
And in fact, it's quite possible that the guns were already there when I actually reached them, because, as I say, I had to go into RHQ to be promoted to captain, I think, on the 3rd, but it may just have been the 4th. But I was already captain there, but I hadn't got enough guns to do anything proper. So I was still doing GPO work.
You mentioned that you were doing quite a lot of firing under HAC control. What sort of targets were you firing at?
No idea. I just, all I've got is that picture and a memory and Bombardier Wilson's note that this was happening that day.
You can't remember what sort of range you were firing at? Or
no.
Anything of that sort?
No, but it certainly wasn't close. It was a perfectly ordinary day in the desert, like any other day, except that I remember that we had this funny business with what were presumably Italians. They may have been Germans, for all I know. I went up there to see them.
What happened on the next day, then, on the 5th?
The 5th was at the honey day. Is that when?
The 8th was the honey day.
The 8th was the honey day. Well, I wouldn't know. Oh, I can tell you what happened on the 5th, 6th or 7th. On one of those days, I made my first trip out as troop commander in an OP truck. And I remember very clearly one incident, because you've seen my map, you realise how this long...
Thin ridge,
yeah. And we were down on to the south of the ridge, and there was Stuka Valley above us. And I was told to go out and do some shooting. I suppose my orders were more explicit than that. And I hedgehopped from boundary to boundary on the map, and eventually feeling very brave, and suddenly in the heat haze there was what looked like a whole armoured division approaching me, and I don't know whether I called the troop into action or the battery into action or what, but I certainly felt very frightened, and dots on the horizon, and I certainly stopped on my ridge and waited for the worst to happen. And as this armoured division approached, it turned out to be a New Zealand Maffey. And so we had cups of tea and luxuries we hadn't had for a long time, because of course that was the way of the land. The New Zealanders by now had come up on our southern flank, and we're fairly close to the western end of Ruisat Ridge.
How far down Ruisat Ridge were you? How far were you from the western end of it?
Well, at that time, middle point 6-3 was our sort of, and I was south of it. But the New Zealanders came up.
On your left, presumably.
On our left, and level with western point 6-3. And indeed, I think, in fact, it was the New Zealanders for a short time, not some people on the western point 6-3. But it was a sort of a sandwich battle at that time.
So you're intermingled with the enemy then on a formation level.
Very easily. July the 5th was also the day. Oh, yes, you've just reminded me. Now, one poor sod, I think his name was Lieutenant O'Day. I can check it if it's ever of any interest, who joined us just before the battle with one of these troops that came in. And I remember very clearly watching him from my OP, so it must have been about the 5th or 6th. It was the 5th. And I remember, in other words, it was the day that I later saw the New Zealand NAFI, because that was my first day out in the OP, and it was that day. His disappearance is mentioned, and I watched him early on go off in a three-tonner, I think, to collect ammunition, and he went west instead of east, and he disappeared into enemy lines. And I watched that happen, and it is recorded. So it wasn't O'Day, it was one of the others who came to join us.
Who was with you with the OP party then? Was it just you and a driver?
Well, by now I'd got our Don, the Tatanaga truck. Bombardier Wilson, who is the chap I've just been quoting from, Tug Wilson. I must have had a signaller. Later on I had Chalky Whitewig in him, and I don't think he was with me at that time. And indeed, Tug Wilson was driving the truck at one stage, and he was the chap who drove into the minefield. Tug Wilson is worth talking about, because he's a great chap. He, today, unless he sold it in the last few months, he was thinking of selling it, owns or has recently owned a family drapery millinery business in Midhurst, in West Street, Midhurst. But I first knew him when he was with us in India. He'd come out about the same time as me he came out as another rank reinforcement. I was an officer reinforcement, and Tug was an extremely well educated, imposing, fairly short physically, but he was a good chap. Very few people of any grade of life would have put Tug as anything other than a good chap. And eventually we put him in for a commission, and he went away to, I think this was actually in India, he went away to be interviewed for his commission, and then we found that our fault was that we hadn't given him a stripe before he went for his interview, so he failed that one. And then we put him in somewhere else, I think in Iraq, and again it failed on some purely administrative factor. And eventually in Egypt, whether it was before the 2nd of July or after, I don't know, we put him in again. And it was probably after, because by now trick cyclism was becoming popular, and he went and was interviewed by a trick cyclist who was himself totally mad, and the trick cyclist turned him down. And eventually he was, when he left 11th Field after being with me in action for long enough for me to know damn well that he was a leader of men and an intelligent man, eventually he got to Oxford at the end of the war. And I think that if he'd gone through his course, he then had to sign on, so he packed in his course and he ended the war as Sergeant Wilson. But he was certainly excellent officer material, and I ought to know, because I was with him in peace and war for quite a long time.
Did you find that it was easy to spot potential officers on a basis of a short period of observation?
No, not on a short period of observation. Well, you can usually pick out potentials, yes. And I suppose that the chap you pick out as potential is right more times than not. But you can't be certain on a short period, no. Indeed, you can't be certain on a longer period, because, of course, being an officer is itself not just one thing. But at the same time, you can usually tell the chap who people are going to follow, and you can also usually tell the chap who's got enough intelligence to know his left from his right. And,
did anything happen, particularly on the 6th, then, after the firing on the 5th?
The next date is the one that he gave, which I think was about the 12th, wasn't it, or the 15th.
Well, the 8th was the day of the Hunnids.
The day of the Hunnids. Oh, well, that was...
What happened on that day?
That was a fairly memorable day in my life, but not particularly in the history of the war. On that day, I think I've already mentioned the occasion when, in connection with our communications, on that day, it was very early in my occupation of observation posts, we went out in the same armoured car, and we came upon one of the crests, and it must have been just south of the ridge, but it wasn't all that far from the ridge, and indeed it was probably very close to our battlefield of the 2nd of July, and there was an anti-tank gun. And a honey. How do I remember this? Do I remember it right? I can remember bits of it so clearly. But which way around it went, I'm not 100% certain of. But I know it was that day that There was a chap from Gloucester Hussars or Gloucester Yeomanry, also in a honey, and he wanted to tow away either the tank or the gun. It may just have been a gun. And we cooked up a little plan, and I registered this damn thing and called for fire for effect on because the wireless wasn't strong enough. I used the RA code, and instead of getting it down as 9400, whatever it was, it went down as 4900, and I was the centre of the barrage. And equally, at some stage in the proceedings, this chap from the Gloucester Hussars went up and he got knocked out. And equally, and this may be what Wilson is referring to, at a later stage I went out one morning to try and use that honey as observation, to make it my OP. And this was one of those early morning stories I was telling you about, because no sooner than I got in there, there was none of these nasty whiplash cracks in the air above it, and we decided not to use it as our OP. And the picture of me running away from that honey may give you an interesting little story or little insight into what life was there, because the picture of me is of a young chap with pearly silk corduroy trousers, a blue Indian Army shirt, a red and blue fore and aft gunner dress cap, and what was in fact the lining of a raincoat. It was a sort of teddy bear thing that I wore over myself throughout the desert, and indeed for some time thereafter, because it was appropriate to surround it. It looked like sand. It was warm in the cold and cool in the warmth. It's not the sort of picture that one would get as a cadet at Octu, thinking of troop commanders in battle.
Why did you wear the dress fore and aft hat?
Primarily, because for most of the war I was with Indian infantry, and this was a sign of their Tope Carnawalla, their gunner. Also for bravado, I suppose. But I like to think it was because it told the Indian infantry that their Tope Carnawalla was in front of them.
When you went out in the OP, how far beyond the gun line would you go normally, looking at targets?
Terribly difficult to. I mean, it varied from 2,000 yards to almost 10,000 yards, depending upon where and what one was doing. And of course, from about the time we're talking of, the guns were fairly static, but up until that time they hadn't been static, so they were probably tagging on behind me at various stages.
What was this Tatanaga truck like?
Well, I've described this already, I think, about its octagonal shape and hexagonal shape, I think. Yes, I have. Well, I've described how you could get me standing in front of the driver and the signaller. Yes, I have. Most certainly. In the next period, the most important thing from 11th Field's point of view is that 11th Field stayed on one or other slope of Rewisit Ridge from its arrival there on the 2nd of July 1942 until the umpteenth Battle of Alamein ebbed away from it on the 2nd of November 1942. And for those 4 months, the 11th Field and the people in it were not away for more than a few hours at a time. That is something which is not easy to for historians to realise or other people to think back on. What happened in between is that we were engaged in a series of attacks. The details I've got down on paper, indeed they're in history. We did an attack, I think I've mentioned, on the 9th. We did another one on the 15th in support of 5th Indian Division. We supported New Zealanders in an attack, one of which nearly achieved its objectives. I remember very clearly watching the 23rd Armour Brigade go into the minefield. 150 tanks that we'd been waiting for weeks that were going to be our saving, and they arrived and were promptly driven into a minefield. Even on that occasion, we damn nearly got there into the Deir al-Shine. I think we spent 3 days at Amaria Station resting. I have an idea, in fact I have a strong memory of the fact that we pulled back for a couple of days nearer the nearer final Alamein for training. That would be after Montgomery had taken over. Shall we? I just got as far as saying that 11th Field was on Rewisit Ridge north or south flanks for the whole of the four months from the 2nd of July 42 to the 2nd of November 42, that in that period we supported various attacks. We also were attacked on various occasions. And I remember at least one of those as being quite unpleasant. Also during that period, of course, we fought in the what to me was by now the third or fourth Battle of Alamein, which is generally known as the Battle of Alam Halfa. Well, that was interesting because by then we had our infantry on the front end of the ridge, fairly well towards the western point 63, and my guns remained throughout in support of them. In other words, firing, pointing roughly due west. But I was given a quite large tank, much bigger than the ones that I'd been in up till then, and sent off to the Alam Halfa Ridge, which was south of east from the gun position. And by day I sat on this ridge and looked towards the Katara Depression, and I had a view such as few gunners have ever had before or since. It's actually quoted in full in the 4th Indian Division history, but I could see the whole of the Africa Corps in effect at one time or another. Tanks stooging along, armoured guns stooging along, guns, batteries coming into action, the whole lot being bombed by the 18 Bostons or other similar aircraft that came over regularly on, we used to call it the something run, forget which run.
The Milk Run.
Milk Run, that's right. and I watch them go over several times a day and unload into that area. Of course, they were all miles out of range of my guns, but I myself wasn't out of range of my guns, so if they had got close to me, I could have caught fire on them. And in the meantime, the guns swivel around almost 180 degrees at night and registered on defensive fire for the infantry on the front end of the ridge. And then after that, before Alamein, the major point of interest is that 4th Indian had taken over from 5th Indian. This is a fact that's, again, not very well documented. A lot of writers tend to regard 5th Indian of having been on the end of the ridge. It wasn't 5th Indian, it was 5th Indian Brigade of 4th Indian Div, although 5th Indian Division had been there earlier. And anyway, I was told one, taken out one day to the track that was our forward bit of wire, and shown four bits of scaffolding pointed to the sky, covered in sacking with a roof on top, and told to go up it and watch what went on. And for, I suppose, something like the last month, the month of October, I spent a large part of my time 40 foot up this tower, watching what went on, and visible to quite a large part of the British Army, and also, I'm afraid, to quite a large part of the German Army. Fortunately, since they couldn't see the base of the tower, they couldn't get the range to it, and I was much safer than I felt. And it was from there that at 9:40 on the 23rd of October, the last battle of Alamein started, with a lot of things flying over my head, fortunately in the right direction.
You were saying earlier on you'd supported a number of attacks going down towards the Deir al-Shine. Yeah.
Towards the Deir al-Shine. Oh, 23rd Brigade.
Why was the Deir al-Shine considered so important?
Well, you only have to look at a map to realise that the whole pivot of the Alamein, what became the Alamein line, is Western Point 63 on the Risa Ridge, and that was vertically above the bottom of the Deir al-Shine. It was the Deir al-Shine therefore gave cover to people coming from the west, and the end point 63 gave visibility to people going either way. And it doesn't require a military genius to realise that the Ruisa Ridge was the key to the position, and there were hinges at both ends, but the key to the position was